This is Audible.
Sounds True presents Conscious Aging, on the nature of change and facing death, with Ram Dass. These two presentations were recorded live at a conference on conscious aging, sponsored by the Omega Institute. The Conscious Aging Conference was the first of its kind to explore the particular social, political, and spiritual issues that elders face as they enter the final phase of life. At the time of this recording, Ram Dass had just turned 60. And now session one, on the nature of change with Ram Dass.
Last year, I was on a late evening train, and the station was closed, so I had to buy the ticket on the train. And I had just become 60. So when the conductor came, I said to him, I'd like a senior citizen ticket. And what I felt when I did that was just what I had felt when I was 18 years old. And I had been from Boston, where the drinking age was 21, but I went to New York with some friends, and the drinking age was 18, and I went into a bar and I said, I'd like a beer, with trepidation that they wouldn't serve me because I was too young. I had the same feeling with the conductor. But he immediately made out the ticket for the senior citizen. I said to him, don't you want to see my ID? And he said, no. And I was shocked. Because until I was 50, I think I saw myself as somewhere between 12 and 14. And then around 50, I started to grow up and I began to consider the fact that I was possibly an adult. So that in earlier years, when I had been in my 30s and a student would come in and say, sir, may I see you? I would take it as a joke. But when I became 60, up until then, I had really treated age as rather uninteresting. And I was busy being spiritual, and spiritual people don't focus on age of the body. But I decided when I was 60 to milk it, to see what I could get out of it, to see if there was any work I should do. So instead of, usually I'm traveling during my birthday, so people can't have birthday parties, but this time I told everybody I wanted birthday parties, and I had many birthday parties. And because 60 was a key year, I have studied in the East a great deal, and at 60 you become a sannyas, which in the stages of life, from 0 to 20, the ashramas or stages of life, from 0 to 20 you're a student, from 20 to 40 you're a householder, raising your children, earning money. From 40 to 60, you start to do spiritual studies and pilgrimages and practices. And at 60, you throw over everything, and you are you're totally free. And 60 is such a key point. In this country, it's a little less, more confusing, because you don't know whether you retire at 55 or 60, and Medicare is until 65, and so you don't quite know when the mark is. There's no clear rite of passage as to when you're old. But I really wanted to milk it, and I realized that I got caught in it. And for about 6 months, I was really busy being 60. I looked at my hand, and I saw my father's hand, and I thought, there's a 60-year-old hand. You know? Bone and blood vessels and wrinkles and spots. Wow, spots. Yeah. You know, the Porcelana ad says, it says, they call these spots aging spots. I call them ugly. Is that an extraordinary ad? I mean, to create suffering? I mean, the other way of looking is they call these ugly. I call them aging spots. But what I had done was I had internalized at some level, more or less consciously, the social clock of aging of our society. Because we are basically a hunting tribe, and what happens to old people in hunting tribes, since hunting tribes have to keep moving, is old people are left behind and they're treated as somewhat irrelevant. And since economic productivity and social roles of achievement are so stressed in this society, in this youth society, I began to feel like it was time for closings rather than openings. I should look at the projects I had left to do. Maybe I should consider retiring from Save a Foundation. Maybe I should do my last book. I mean, I was really climbing into it. Maybe I should take 6 months a year now off. And I started to notice, I travel and I use carry-on baggage because I don't like baggage claim waiting. So I noticed that the corridors to the plane seem to be getting longer. And I thought, aha, it's happening. And I reacted to it in interesting ways. Part of me was sort of steeping myself in, okay, what's it going to be like to be older? I'll slow down. I'll honor this. And the other part was doing this bizarre behavior where last summer I spent some time helping my colleague build his house with adobe bricks. And I would be in this long line of people, all of whom were about 20 to 30-year-old Mexican laborers, and me and my friend, and the bricks weighed about 30 to 40 pounds, and we would toss them up the hill from one to another. And we would work from 7:30 in the morning till 5 at night, at which point they'd go out to dinner and to play. And I would stagger to bed. But I wouldn't give up. I did it. And then I thought, well, my body's out of shape. So I went to Gold's Gym. And I got a trainer. And now Gold's Gym is wonderful because it's where everybody comes with all those kind of really muscle-bound, huge forms. You know, these things that, you know. And they have mirrors all around the sides for these people who admire themselves, but because I'm nearsighted without my glasses, I couldn't see in the mirrors. All I saw were these huge forms going by, and so pretty soon I was starting to walk like this, because since I couldn't see myself, I just assumed I was one of them. And but the trainer, as we went through the regimen, at one point I was sitting there deciding whether I would live or die, and she said, "Are you all right?" And I knew she wouldn't be asking that to one of them, so. I remembered my father's little poem, "It's not the crow's feet under your eyes that make you old, or the gray in your hair, I'm told, but when your mind makes a contract your body can't fill, you're over the hill, brother, you're over the hill." But I wasn't ready to give up, so in November I went with a 33-year-old friend of mine to the South Pacific to do 2 months of boogie boarding. And for those of you that don't know, that it might have passed you by, a boogie board is a plastic board, and you go out in the waves and you ride on the wave. So I found myself in Tahiti and in the Marquesas Islands. And my friend would leap into the surf and rush out to get the waves. And these waves are coming in, and I would be struggling to get through the wave. And I get out there, and there were all these, not only weren't they 60 years old, they weren't 50, and they weren't 40, and they weren't even 30. I mean, they were about 15. Only one person gets a wave, it turns out, if you really want to ride the right place. So I was fighting these 15, 20-year-olds. And at one point, I took a wrong turn, and I ended up on this coral reef with the waves pounding down on me and the coral cutting into my legs. And you know how long it takes for coral to heal. And everybody was screaming at me to do something, which I couldn't hear over the waves. And I thought, what am I doing? Is it possible that I could say enough already? I've saved my father's cane for whenever. There's a lovely Chinese story about that, about the old Chinese man who's retired. He's too old to work in the garden, and he's sitting on the porch, and his son is tilling the garden with his son as a wife and family. And the son looks up at the old man and he thinks, you know, he's so old, he just eats food. What good is he? He says, no, it's time for him to be done. So he went out and he made a wooden box, and he put the box on the wheelbarrow. And he rolled the wheelbarrow up to the porch, and he said, Father, get in. The father got into the box, and the son put a cover on the box and started to wheel the box towards the cliff. And as he got to the edge of the cliff, there was a knocking from inside the box. And he said, Yes, Father. And the father said, Well, I understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, son, but might I suggest that you just throw me over and save the box, because your children will probably need it later. But one of the things that's helped me from not getting too trapped in our cultural models is that I do travel a great deal in other cultures. And in other cultures, I'm always surprised at how different the feelings are that are generated around variables. Like in India, when I went there last time, 2 years ago, one of my lovely old friends up in a village in the mountains said to me, Ramdas, you're looking so old. He said, you're so gray. Now, at first, my reaction to that was my Western cultural reaction of, oh, God, no, that's terrible. But then when I quieted down, I heard the tone with which he was saying it. He was saying it with great respect and delight. Like I had now become one of the elders of the society. And he was saying, wow, you've done it. You've grown old. How great. And what I found is that after I live in places like Guatemala or Malaysia or Thailand or Burma or Italy or France or Spain or Polynesia, where there are extended families, where everybody has natural roles within the structure, and where old people are part of the families and the old and the young are wise fools together and the whole thing is quite built in, then you come back to where this culture, where we have, quote, an aging problem. And I realize that we are gathered here because of our cultural pathology. That were it not for that, we wouldn't need this so much. Because in many cultures, this was all built in a natural way. And in our zeal to be independent, we have thrown away the baby with the bath a little bit. And we've ended up where we have alienated ourselves across generations instead of embracing ourselves across generations. Creating these kinds of supportive communities where the roles of elders are obvious and clear. In our society, of course, where technology moves so fast, we get outdated, so that the question of what wisdom elders have that is useful. I mean, I'm only at WordPerfect 5.0. And I realize now that I already can't talk the language of my friend's 12-year-old son. And I moved from a typewriter to a computer, and I kept saying to myself, old dogs can learn new tricks, old dogs can learn new tricks, old dogs can learn new tricks, and I put it over my computer. But I don't know how many more old tricks I'm going to learn, and I may just decide to be outdated. But I think that we have to recognize that we are living in a system that has gotten out of balance, in which the zeal for independence and individuality has left us alienated from the structures not only of family and community, but from nature, from recognizing our identity as part of biotic communities and part of other things, that all of which give an intuitive, innate meaning to aging. And they give you a feeling of the appropriateness of the place. Most of us live in urban areas where we are living almost totally surrounded by the projections of the human mind. And very rarely are we living so close to nature and earth that we are experiencing in our blood and our being the cycles of cold and warm, of leaves falling, of the feelings of nature, of death, of birth, of aging. And it's a harsh reality at one level, and it's the horrible beauty of the wisdom of nature that we often have shielded ourselves from, and in that shielding we have lost something because we've been afraid to look at the nature of aging and death. Robert Kestenbaum says, "The limitations and distortions of our core vision of what it means to be a person in our culture become starkly evident in old age. If to be an old person is to suffer abandonment, disappointment, and humiliation, this is not a geriatric problem. It is the disproof of our whole shaky pudding, technology, science, and all. If our old people are empty, our vision of life is empty." The nature of aging has to do with change, obviously. And the nature of changing phenomena is that they are endlessly fascinating. We get fascinated with that which changes. When it starts to happen to who we think we are, the fascination turns into fear. The first level of change that we have to attend to is the physical nature of change with aging. As I read this list, it'll be very familiar to many of you. Arthritis, neuritis, insomnia, constipation, poor circulation, high blood pressure. I went to the doctor the other day and he said, "Your blood pressure's high." He said, "Would you do whatever you do to lower it?" I said, "What I do to lower it is not visit doctor's offices. That's what I do. It's called the white coat blood pressure." Nervous tension, atrophying muscles, bones breaking easily, motor nerve signals slower, lungs less oxygen, loss of mobility, can't hear as well, can't see as well, run out of steam sooner, days when you feel sick and nauseous, questions about continence. Now, those changes themselves are so fascinating that I can take you to whole societies in the sun in St. Petersburg, for example, where there are hundreds of thousands of people who are endlessly reciting the lists of these changes to each other. Mostly their own fascinate them the most. However, they do listen to each other so that they can give fair hearing, so that they can have time for their own. But you don't say, "How are you?" And that's real, and it's very real, and it's very painful and very confusing, because the body just doesn't do what it used to do, and it does a lot of things it didn't used to do. And while you can see how real that is for those people, when you put in the places of those people who are the same age, now just put on those benches Einstein, Arthur Rubinstein, Pablo Picasso, Rembrandt, George Bernard Shaw, Monet, Chagall, Bob Hope, Grandma Moses, and Margaret Mead. And you can't imagine them sitting around doing that same thing, can you? So it's clearly not age, is it? It's where the mind grabs hold and which changes it focuses on, right? I mean, just that's a... Now, around that one is so endlessly fascinating, we've developed a great deal of humor around it. Johnny Carson, soon to be former Johnny Carson, says, "I know a man who gave up smoking, drinking, sex, and rich food. He was healthy right up to the time he committed suicide." Groucho Marx said, "In middle age, you go to bed knowing you'll hoping you'll feel better in the morning. In old age, you go to bed hoping you'll have a morning." Robert Benchley said, "I feel fine at 50, except for an occasional heart attack." These identifications are so intense, it's extremely hard to break them. But as you heard, you could feel that it was possible to lift out of them and to see the body as a vehicle. In the East, you see the body as something you have incarnated into, and it's a vehicle that it's like a spacesuit for working on this planet, on this plane of reality. And your spacesuit, I have two cars. One is 19 years old and one's 18 years old. Now, to me, they're new cars because I remember them. But one of them just failed the smog test in California, and it's... And I realize now that it's just a car. But to be able to say it's just a body in the same way, because most of us have identified so with the... It's like identifying with your car, and somebody says, "How do you do? Who are you?" And you say, "I'm a Ford." You know, like I'm an arthritic, you know, like I have gout. "How do you do? I have gout." You know, it's the same thing. You're identifying with the vehicle. I mean, it's a charming old vehicle. It's just falling apart, but I can, with a little tender care, I can keep it together for a little while longer. However, when you get to the psychological things that change, it's a whole other ball game. When you work with the psychological changes, because there are a lot of new ones you face that are psychological changes. Some of them just increase and some of them appear that have never appeared before. Let me give you a little list to play with. You handled the physical list well? Try this one. Despair. Depression. Feeling abandoned, lonely, worthless, frustrated, worrying, doubting, vulnerable, forgetful, losing self-confidence, petty, irritable, fear of the future, obsessed with possessions, meaninglessness, friendlessness, fear of being penniless, no one to touch, loss of psychological power. Worship and fear of doctors. Suspicion. Paranoia. Those all sound pretty real. And they are coming and going and appearing more and more frequently and changing. As your social support system changes, as you may have to leave the home, as you may have to lose friends, as you may have to find that you have less responsibility, as the reward systems you worked for don't work anymore, you try to maintain psychological security by holding on to things as they are. And if you can hear the predicament that things change. My car gets old. My body gets old. That's obvious. The hard one to hear is that thoughts and feelings are things and things change. And that your identification with your thoughts and feelings is another source of the cause of the suffering. What we usually do under those conditions is we work in a therapeutic sense, psychologically, to try to find some psychological model that will allow us to age. And we try to substitute that for the one that is depressed and fearful and frightened. It's a horizontal shift. And there are certain qualities that we look for, we try to cultivate. Martin Buber says, to be old is a glorious thing when one has not unlearned what it means to begin. He's talking about somebody who knew how to begin. He said, he was not at all young, but he was old in a young way, knowing how to begin. And most of the social programs that are not for the physical body are for psychological well-being. And they're in supporting education, the Elder Hostel, travel. If you read the AARP magazine, Maturity, you just see lots of stuff around keeping your psychological mental health good and your physical health good. To continue to do things, to be active, etc. To see aging as a challenge, as a psychological challenge, a challenge that is sufficient to motivate you to grow, but not so extreme so as to induce depression, regression. In other words, not beyond our adaptive capacity. To psychologically study the way in which we are responding to change in a habitual way that is similar to the way we responded to change at puberty, the way we responded to change in childhood, and realize we're just reliving psychological patterns over and over again, and to break our habits and get out of those things. Part of the psychological mental health of elders and aging has to do now with political power. With the Grey Panthers, with the AARP, with power. Now every bus will be a kneeling bus because we have the votes. Now that's a good example of something that is extremely useful and important and relevant when older people say, look, we are not going to be disempowered by a youth culture. We're going to redefine the game of what this culture respects. And we're not going to wait for somebody else to give it to us. We're going to take it. and we're going to take it with our political power. That is great. But I want to represent another voice here and say, do that and do it effectively. Don't get trapped in it. Don't get trapped in worldly power, because the business of aging has some other agenda to it as well. One of the things that eldering allows us to do, or aging rather, allows us to do, is become more eccentric. That's a psychological shift in role. Before, where you had to be a certain way, now you can sort of let it all fall apart a little bit more. There's a wonderful poem that many of you know, I'm sure, by Jenny Joseph. It's a warning. She said, "When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple with a red hat which doesn't go, and it doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin sandals and say, we've no money for butter. I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired and gobble up samples in shops and press alarm bells and run my stick along the public railings and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain and pick the flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit. You can wear terrible shirts and grow more fat and eat 3 pounds of sausage at a go, or only bread and pickles for a week, and hoard pens and pencils and beer mats and things in boxes. Ah, but now we must have clothes to keep us dry and pay the rent and not swear in the street and set a good example for the children. We must have friends to dinner and read the papers. But maybe I ought to practice a little now, so people who know me are not too shocked and surprised when suddenly I am old and start to wear purple." That's, of course, T.S. Eliot's Proof Rock. I grow old, I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. And one more poem that I found in a Hallmark card. Of course, the psychological fear that we have the most is of losing our mind. And this says, "Just a line to say I'm living, that I'm not among the dead, though I'm getting more forgetful and more mixed up in the head. For sometimes I can't remember when I stand at the foot of the stair if I must go up for something or if I've just come down from there. And before the fridge, so often my poor mind is full of doubt. Have I just put food away, or have I come to take some out? And there are times when it's dark out with my nightcap on my head, I don't know if I'm retiring or just getting out of bed. So if it's my turn to write you, there's no need in getting sore. I may think that I have written and don't want to be a bore. Remember, I do love you. I wish you were here, and it's nearly mail time, so I'll say goodbye, dear. There I stood beside the mailbox with my face so very red. Instead of mailing you my letter, I have opened it instead. I love my new bifocals. My dentures fit me fine. My hearing aid is perfect, but Lord, I miss my mind." Now, it's much harder to hear the possibility that one can extricate oneself from that which changes when the changes involves one's own personality. Because while you may be able to see the body as object, it's very hard to see the personality as object, because you've identified with it for so long. You think that's who you are. And now we're getting more into the depth of the matter, because the question one asks is, Is there a place to stand in relation to change where one is not frightened by it? Is there a place to stand in the presence of change where one can be with the changes, even enjoy the changes, work with the changes, become an elder, do all the things that changing involves, and at the same moment cultivate equanimity, spaciousness, emptiness, awareness, clarity? And that's really what the issue of spiritual, of the deep spiritual work is about. Now, there are stages of that work, and the first stage, I think, is the recognition of what is most comfortable for people in spiritual dimension is something called soul, which says you are still a separate entity, but you aren't the incarnation. You aren't what was born. So you aren't your personality and you aren't your body. Here are just a few images to work with in thinking about this. One is by Yeats. An aged man is but a paltry thing, tattered coat upon a stick. Unless soul claps its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. O sages standing in God's holy fire, be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal. It knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Pull my soul out of the identification with the body. And in T.S. Eliot's poem, East Coker, as we grow older, the world becomes stranger, the pattern more complicated of dead, of living. Old men and women ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for further union, a deeper communion. Through the dark, cold, and empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning. You and I are paying the price of having grown up in such a materially oriented society, such an externalized society, such a society that measures people in terms of their products, their achievements, their possessions, their knowledge, instead of cultivating the quality of being. In the East, one spends one's life, from a spiritual sense, in preparing for aging and death. We have spent most of our lives in denying aging and death. And the predicament we face now is that once we become older, when we suddenly realize there is another agenda, it's harder to do it now because it's harder to not be distracted by all of the changes that are happening in our bodies and our minds. And that is why you are encouraged spiritually. It says, die in the morning so you need not die at night. And that has to do with go through the spiritual transformations when you are young so that when you get old, you will have built up the resonance within yourself to be able to transform the changes without getting caught in them. Mahatma Gandhi had spent so many years in inner spiritual practice and with the mantra he did, Ram, 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 with his beads, Ram, 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 that when he walked out into the garden that day and a man came up and shot him 4 times at blank range right in the chest, as Gandhi was falling over, he didn't say, oof, or save India, or you are forgiven. He said, Ram. He was so ready to move forward that at the moment, the unexpected moment, he was ready to utter that mantra which would take him into the next space. The depth of the understanding of that particular image, of the preparation, not just for the moment of death, but for the process of aging, it is a lifetime's work. To know how to grow old is the masterwork of wisdom, one of the most difficult chapters in the great art of living, and one best done early on. T.S. Eliot has one other quote. He says, we cannot stick to the moving finger of time on the surface of the sphere, but must descend into the still point of the turning world. That is, one of the traps that our mind is in is the trap of time. And aging has to do with time. And I must ask you, is there a part of you that is not in time? And if so, find it and rest in it. That's the whole mystical journey. Now, the predicament is the part of you that is not in time, you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't hear it, you can't even think about it. And yet it is. You can only be it. You can't know it. Because the thinking mind knows objects, and objects are in time. What a frustrating thing. It's like having a flashlight that you shine on this and that, on a memory, on a plan, on a sensation, on a feeling. But when does the flashlight shine on itself? And the flashlight itself is that part of you which you could call, whatever you call it is just going to be a word which isn't going to be it, but let's call it awareness. Awareness has no time. It has no space. It doesn't die. It wasn't born. It's not going anywhere. Everybody is having continuous experience or continuous understanding or resting in awareness. But you are so fascinated with what you are being aware of, you never notice the awareness itself. Isn't that strange? What you begin to see is the way in which the journey, the spiritual journey, is one of going deeper and deeper into your being, to go in behind that which changes, to find that which does not change. And it's not a that, but find not change. And in that process, you start to use the things of your life as your vehicles of doing it. And all of the things I've talked about, the physical breakdown, the psychological breakdown, all can become the stuff you use in order to go behind it by saying, not this, not this, not this. And when you know how to use aging to go behind time, then you begin to see that all of that stuff that's happening to you not only might not be bad, it might even be grace. There's the story of the man who had a horse. And the horse ran away, and his neighbor came up and said, oh, that's terrible. The man said, you never know. And the next day, the horse came back, and it was leading two other wild horses. And the neighbor said, that's wonderful. And the farmer said, you never know. And then his son was training one of the wild horses, and while he was riding the wild horse, he fell off and broke his leg. And the neighbor came up and said, that's terrible. And the farmer said, yeah. And then the Cossack army came through recruiting everybody, taking all the young men that were able, but they didn't take the son because he had a broken leg. And the neighbor came up and said, "That's wonderful." And the farmer said, "Yeah." And on it goes, you see. You begin to experience that the very stuff of aging becomes stuff to work with for your spiritual journey. There are some advantages of aging in that you are like the Chung Tzu's old gnarled tree that no woodsman cuts down anymore. So it can do its own business. You become irrelevant, so you can do inner work. Here's Frances, a resident in a nursing home. She says, "Lack of physical strength keeps me inactive and often silent. They call me senile. Senility is a convenient peg on which to hang nonconformity," she says. "A new set of faculties seems to be coming into operation. I seem to be waking to a larger world of wonderment, to catch little glimpses of the immensity and diversity of creation. More than at any other time of my life, I seem to be aware of the beauties of our spinning planet and the sky above. Old age is sharpening my awareness." That's senility. I had an extraordinary image of this when I was taking care of my father, who died about 3 years ago at 90. And over the years, my father had been a very effective political, social animal, very successful. As he got older, during the last 3 years, he got very quiet inside. And he just smiled a lot. And I used to sit with him and hold his hand, and we'd look at sunsets. We had never done that all our lives because we were always busy. What do we do now? You know, that kind of active world. So a man came to visit, a relative came to visit my father, who had never gotten along well with him. And he said, "Hi, how are you doing?" And my father just smiled at him. And the fellow walked out of the room and he said, "That bastard, he still won't talk to me." And then my aunt came along, who loved my father incredibly. She said, "George, how are you?" And he just smiled at her. And she said, "Oh, poor George, what have they done to you? Where are you? You've gone away." There he and I were sitting. We were both in ecstasy, just sitting and smiling. We were totally at peace. It was like washing the Buddha all the time. It was incredible. I mean, he was just blissed out all the time. He didn't even know himself. They were both miserable. Isn't that interesting? They were miserable because their model of who he should be because of who he was, but that isn't who he is. And the interesting question is whether you will allow the moment to be real or not. The wonderful line, "The very frailty of age guards its secrets. The inner world of the old is seldom worded. To speak of half-formed ideas which come with attunement to inner self is to destroy their growth," said Margaret Keyes. See, when I say to you, you are looking for a place in you that is not form, that is not in time, that is not in space, it's not something you can talk about. All your words are just fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the moon. And when you get old and you can't talk so much, then you're in a position where you may be able to hear those components that are not talkable about. Otherwise, you keep reducing the world to what you can talk about. It's so interesting how age works to the advantage spiritually. I mean, I go to Burma, say, to sit in meditation for 2 months. I go into a cell, I sit down, no books, no letters, no television, nobody to talk to, nowhere. I just sit and go inward. And I go into as quiet a place as I can. But look what happens when you get old. You go deaf, you go blind, you've got arthritis, you can't move around. What an ideal time to meditate. I mean, if any message was clearer, that's it. Isn't that the optimum time to be able to sit down and shut up and really listen inward? And yet we treat it as if it's an error or a failing. Isn't that bizarre? Seems so to me. The next issue, of course, that we have to deal with is the issue of dying. Suzuki Roshi said, life is like setting sail aboard a boat which is about to go out into the ocean and sink. You ready for that?
Not me. I'm not going to sink.
I have a life preserver. And Rilke said that one can contain death, the whole of death, can hold it to one's heart gentle and not refuse to go on living is inexpressible. The key spiritual work that aging demands we focus upon is the way in which we relate to death. And the way you relate to death is a function of how much you are identified with that which dies. When you were born, you were undifferentiated all of it. And then you went into somebody training. And you became somebody. You became a defined, boundaried somebody. You were trained by people who thought they were somebody. And in the zeal with which you were trained into your somebodyness, what you lost was your connection with the unity that exists behind the diversity. You just got so focused on your separateness, you lost the unity. And the spiritual journey is awakening back into the unity, the oneness, the spirit, the God that permeates and is all things. Not so that you get lost in the unity and forget the diversity or your uniqueness, but that you regain the balance. Because once you have in you a recognition of that part of you which is part of everything, which is part of the one, your fear of death is dissipated immensely. As long as you are identified only with your separateness, you are afraid of death. And that fear is going to color all of your years. And the art of being able to look directly at death and directly at suffering, that art, the ability to keep your heart open in hell, to look at what is, look at all of it, is a function of your ability to find in yourself that which is not changing, which is not separate, which is not vulnerable to time and to space. That's the spiritual work. That's the journey of aging. So to undertake this spiritual journey, what is required? Zalman talked about doing our philosophical homework. That is, now instead of just reading People magazine, New York Times, whatever, Variety, start to look for those kinds of literature, resources, books that reflect about these issues of metaphysics, of who you are and what you're doing here. If you have a religious context, do it through your religious context. Read Rabbi Nachman, read the Baal Shem Tov, read etc. Or read St. Augustine, or etc. recognize the stages of life and honor them, which I would almost do if I could find them. Well, see, I can't honor them because there they are. Confucius said, Confucius said, at 15, I set my heart upon learning. At 30, I had planted my feet firm upon the ground. At 40, I no longer suffered from perplexities. At 50, I knew what were the biddings of heaven. At 60, I heard them with a docile ear. At 70, I could follow the dictates of my heart, for what I desired no longer overstepped the boundaries of right. Now, a lot of people talk about old people don't have to give up their sexual appetites. You don't, but when they fall away, what a blessing. How much free time you have. I never knew. I mean, I don't want to say undercut the game of old people are sexy. I think that's wonderful, and it's sensual, and it's all great. But my God, you don't even have to keep playing with toys all your life. There are other business you have. Don't denigrate it by saying, I failed because I can't get it up, or I can't make it, or I can't do this. I mean, that's absurd. Well, that's going to certainly... So recognizing and honoring stages of life is extremely important. Look at change itself and reflect about that, as we have been doing here. See how, as I've talked about, losing your hearing as a value, not a loss. See how you can use your aging as a vehicle to help you in your spiritual work, rather than being something that's an obstacle. Recognizing in yourself the conflicting forces, the forces that make you want to stay effective in the world, having love and friendship and all of that, and the other part that wants to be contemplative and go inside, and really give that contemplative inside part some space, water it a little bit, give it some sunlight to grow, instead of treating it as, oh God, I don't want to go out today, as if it's some kind of an error. Give yourself psychologically the opportunity to grieve for the end of dreams, for the end of childhood, for all the people that go away, for the loss of each thing, thing upon thing upon thing. The loss of competence, the loss of people, the loss of lifestyle, the loss of your body functioning, etc. Stop feeding the drama of aging. Your denial of aging or your milking of it by being so attached to it are both getting in the way of realizing that who you are has no age. Who you are is in a body that has age, it's in a personality that is aging and changing, but you yourself aren't. Reflect about death and become friendly with it. Find a community around you of people who would like to really grow inwardly if you're lucky enough to find them. They're called satsang or sangha or the family or the community of spirit. If you don't, then you've got books of tzaddiks, of staritsas, of wise women, of all of that. Tune back into nature more deeply so you can feel the cycles, the natural cycles of which your body and your personality are a part. Find practices of meditation, meditation on impermanence, meditation on suffering and the end of suffering, meditation on non-self, meditation on dependency. Learn how to act in the world in caring and compassionate way without being trapped in being the actor, by using it all to go inward more deeply, more deeply. Just to give you a flavor, I'm about to draw to a close here. These are the kind of spiritual teachings I work with. You should rest in naturalness. Clear, empty, and naked mind essence, free from any concerns. Just rest in your awareness. When your body falls sick, don't indulge in it, but rest in naturalness. Look into the painful sensation itself. The pain doesn't cease. However, you will directly realize the innate state of awareness, free from any thought about where it hurts, what it hurts, how it hurts, as well as the object of the pain. At that moment, the sickness grows less intense and becomes more insubstantial. Regard disturbing emotions from within the space of emptiness. Any disturbing emotion that may arise is wisdom the moment you relax in naturalness. Look directly into it. Don't deliberately reject it or regard it as a fault or indulge it in concreteness or even regard it as a virtue. Just look at it and keep coming back into spaciousness. Come back into spaciousness. The result of the kinds of spiritual work I'm talking about is that you are growing towards being equanimous, peaceful, where you see that the process of the aging is itself the creative act. And you see the way in which you are your own creation. And when you are creating from peace and equanimity and the quiet spaciousness of being in love in the universe, the unity of the universe, you become a wise elder into the society. When you are dependent on others, the way in which you are dependent is a message to other people to help them get free of their fear of dependency. The people I work with who are dying, I have to tell you, are my great teachers. They are people who, in the way they work with these processes, keep teaching me. So understand that Mahatma Gandhi's line, he was on a train, it was rolling out of the station, a reporter rushed up and said, "Mahatmaji, give me a message to take back to the people." He had just time to scribble on a paper bag, he handed out the bag, and it said, "My life is my message." I invite you to look at your life and see what message it is you are. And when you find that part of you that is afraid, that is caught in time and that which changes, get to work. There's no better time to do it than now. Thank you.
Conscious Aging, Session 2, on Facing Death with Ram Dass.
Good morning. For some of you, coming to this morning session is a lark, and for some of you, it's a little threatening and frightening. And I recognize all of that, and I appreciate that we all realize that part of our agenda as people of any age is to find some way of being with the idea of death and I know that's why you are here. There's a tombstone inscription that I think many of you have heard.
Dear friend, please know as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. Prepare yourself to follow me. And we are preparing ourselves. I realize it's very presumptuous to get up and talk about death as if I know. But I have a lot of chutzpah. That's Sanskrit for... And something has happened to me as a result of my meanderings through the realms of consciousness over the past 30 years that has changed my attitudes towards death. And a lot of the fear that death generated that led to denial has gone from me. And I'm one of the strange people that absolutely delights and enjoys being with people as they're dying. In fact, it is as such incredible grace for me that in the morning when I know I'm going to be with such a person, I get absolutely thrilled in my body, in my being. Because I know I'm going to have an opportunity to be in the presence of truth. So I would like to share with you this perspective and stories and images and talk for maybe half of our time and then work with questions and answers. We are living at a time where birth has come out of the closet in the past 20, 30, 40 years, and death is just beginning to come out of the closet. It is now beginning to be acceptable to consider the possibility that people actually die. Usually in our culture, it has been put behind doors, behind sheets, behind, you don't talk to the children about it, you don't show anybody. And for me, who has grown up in that culture, it was quite an experience when I started to live in India, where when somebody dies, they are put on a pallet and wrapped in a silk sheet or a sheet, and then carried through the streets to the burning grounds. And the with Satyahe, Satyaha, with the a mantra being recited as they go through the streets. And the death is public for everybody to see. The body is right there. It's not in a box. It's not hidden. And because India is a place of the extended family and very few and inadequate hospitals, most people are dying at home, so that most people, as they grow up, have been in the presence of someone dying. While in our culture, an amazing number of people, even at middle age, have never been in the presence of someone dying. They have walked away from it and hidden from it. And I was one of them, and I have certainly changed in the past 25 years. I think the reason that I changed was that, and I know this will offend some of you, but it's truth is always difficult, that through my experiences with psychedelic chemicals, you might say, particularly originally the mushrooms of Mexico, which were used by curanderos and oracles in Mexican religions, and the mushrooms have been used throughout religious history, actually, for mystical experiences. Through that experience, first experience, I came in contact with a part of my being that as an adult I was not, I had not identified with, I had not acknowledged. And it was a part of my being that lay behind my social roles, behind my personality. And it was indeed a part of my being that didn't seem to have much to do with birth and death. It could be called soul or awareness or spirit or God or whatever. And for me, who was a Western social psychologist, professor at Harvard, materialist, philosophical materialist, that experience was an extremely confusing one, because there was nothing in my armamentarium of scientific methodology or in psychology that prepared me to deal with that component of my being. And once I experienced that being, it started to profoundly change the nature of my life after that, of who I thought I was. Because up until then, I had identified with that which dies. And as long as you identify with that which dies, there is always fear of death, because it's the fear of cessation of existence. And I realize now that although I didn't know the form that it would take after death, I knew that what there was about something about the essence of my awareness was outside of death. Now, the interesting thing for me at that time was that when I had that experience, it was what I called ineffable, indescribable, because I had no concepts to deal with what I was finding in my being. And probably had I been more emotionally connected to my Jewish roots, I would have found in the Kabbalah and in all of the Book of Brilliance and so on, I would have found metaphors and analogies for what I experienced. But I wasn't. And the book that came to my attention, that was brought to my attention by Aldous Huxley, who was part of our project and visiting at MIT that year, was a book called The Tibetan Book of the Dead. And what happened to me when I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead was I was reading descriptions of the direct experiences I was having with the mushrooms. Now, this was very confusing to me, again, because this book was 2,500 years old. I thought I was at the leading edge of the unknown. And here was a very ancient text, a book that was used by monks, by lamas, read to fellow lamas at the point they were dying and for the days following their death, whispered in their ear, about the process of dying. Out of that, my colleague Timothy Leary and my other colleague Ralph Metzner and I began to see the Tibetan Book of the Dead in metaphorical terms as a story of psychological death and rebirth, even though it was used as physical death and rebirth. And so we did a book called The Psychedelic Experience, which was a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead for going through this psychological death rebirth. And I really think that although it has been made trivial in a way, the idea that's a biblical idea, the idea of dying and being born into truth or wisdom or spirit, is really what our business is that we're talking about when we deal with death. And that as you have extricated yourself from a solid identification with body and with personality and with materiality, you begin to have spaciousness to allow for the possibility that death may be part of process rather than end. And I think I feel that very deeply. People say, do you believe that there is continuity after death? And I say, I don't believe it, it is, which offends my scientific friends no end. But belief is something you hold with your intellect, and this has gone way beyond that now. So you may be just sharing my total pathology. I have no idea, and that it's up to your intuition to decide that. I would never know if I was completely crazy, so. A to show you how crazy I am, I have a friend who some of you have met through books, a friend named Emmanuel. Emmanuel is a spook, a being that has dropped his body somewhere along the way and speaks through a lovely woman named Pat Rodegast. And I must point out to you when I'm talking about channeled beings that all beings that don't have bodies aren't wise. That there are as many schlock people without bodies as there are with them, and there are a lot of well-meaning beings who've left their bodies and want to send back messages like buy United States Steel, and they don't know any more than they knew before. So you have to be very discriminating when dealing with disembodied beings in the same way as you are with embodied beings. But Emmanuel has a lot of nachas. He has a lot of real wisdom, and he's like an uncle to me. He's just wonderful fun. And when I said to Emmanuel, I deal a lot with the fear of dying in this culture and death. What should I tell people? And he said, Ram Dass, tell them that death is absolutely safe. Now, just put those two things together and realize what a far out line that is. Death is absolutely safe. And then he added one more image. He said, it's like taking off a tight shoe. Okay, can you hear that one? Like taking off a tight shoe. Now, just imagine that you as spirit or awareness have contained yourself in an incarnation or contained it in a conceptual model of who you are and on a storyline. And then at some point, you dissolve out of that, you break out of that, and there is this incredible release quality. Well, these kinds of things I'm talking about are very different from the way in which our culture is presently treating death. Presently, we see death as an enemy. The medical profession sees death as a failure. The temple of life is the intensive care unit. The medical person is the priest. And when that became unacceptable, we then moved towards the hospice movement. Now, the hospice movement is extremely useful in coming back to a psychologically supportive environment, because intensive care units don't allow babies, they don't allow dogs, they don't allow flowers, they don't allow the human connections that give you psychological support. And the hospice movement was very interested in providing psychological support. And as such, it has played a useful role. And it provides a warm setting either in the home or in a hospice residential space for people to have psychological support and respect and dignity as a personality while they are dying. I want to support hospice and at the same moment express my reservations, because hospice, in order to be fully acceptable into the economic structures of the society, meaning Medicare and so on, has avoided the spiritual aspects. And it has done so quite intentionally, actually. And I find that Cecily Saunders, who started the hospice movement, who I think is a very caring human being, still says death is an outrage. And I personally don't experience that. So that I want to support the hospice movement as a step in the right direction, but I want to say that we have a lot further to go in terms of what our possibilities are for creating environments for people as they're dying, where they can have the spaciousness to explore the process they're going through without being surrounded by people who feel sorry for where they are. Because, and what I have tried to do with Stephen Levine and his wife Andrea and Dale Borglum, a number of people, is over the years create a space. We've had different programs like Dial a Death, where you can call up and talk to people and have pillow talk with people to share with them the process of staying conscious through dying. We've had the Dying Center. We had one in New Mexico. My model was, was that I knew that my being with people that were dying, here's my predicament. I'm incarnated, and I have all of the stuff that goes with an incarnation. The deepest one is what's called first chakra, for those of you in those systems, understanding those systems, which is the fear of survival. It's preoccupation with survival. And I know that if I am going to work on myself spiritually in this lifetime, one of the things I want to do is work with my fear of death. And the way I can do that is by being around death during my lifetime. In the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, for example, they send the monks out to the cemeteries to spend the nights in the cemeteries. And in the tradition, they throw the bodies out there uncovered for the birds to eat it. So the whole thing is ecologically sound. And so you go out there and you sit with the bloated corpse, the fly-infested corpse, the skeleton, and you get a chance to be aware of all the process of nature. And you watch your own disgust and loathing and fear, and as I am now, so you will be. Prepare yourself to follow me. And it's in a way beginning to see the whole way that the body is decaying and meditating on decay, so that you can find the place in you that has nothing to do with that by opening to that, because the denial of it keeps you stuck in it. That's the problem. Denial keeps you fixated. And that's why I wanted to get as close to the dying process as I possibly could. So the combination of the two things, one was that something had happened inside of me, which was a spiritual awakening that made death feel different. And the second was that I wanted to work on myself and be close to the deepest fear of incarnation, which was the fear of death. That combination led me to start in about 1963 to work with dying people and to want to be available to them. Now, what could I do? I wasn't a doctor. I wasn't a nurse. I really had very little. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an ordained priest. So the question, what I could offer a human being, was that I've purified the way to say it now over the years. What I have offered another human being is a spacious environment with my mind in which they can die as they need to die. I realize that I have no moral right to define how another person should die, that each individual has their own karma, their own stuff to work out. It's not my job to say, you should die beautifully or you should die this way. I don't even know why, how they should die. Let me give you an example of that. I was helping my stepmother die. She was 69 or so, and she had developed cancer. When she developed the cancer, she and I were good buddies, and my father was 18 years older than she was. And so I was, my role was to be with her and to help her through this process. And she and I went to the doctors together, and we did the whole thing of getting all of the reports and dealing with all the emotions. Now, she was a very tough New England lady. She was a wonderful, grounded, tough, poker-playing, smoking, just fun. She was argumentative and tough and willful. And she had this kind of stiff upper lip way of living life. And so she was doing that around her death. And my job wasn't to say, hey, Phyllis, you should open to this. That wasn't my moral, right? My job was just to be there with her. And I would lay on the bed, and we'd hold each other, and we'd just talk. And we'd talk about death and what we thought it might be like and all. But she was still very, very strong. But the pain of the cancer was very intense. And over time, it finally wore away her will. And there came a moment shortly before, maybe 4 or 5 days before her death, when she gave up. And now in our culture, giving up is seen as failure. Everybody says, you know, keep trying, keep trying. And we surround people that are dying with a certain kind of falseness that comes out of our own fear. When my mother, my natural mother, was dying, I remember it was back in 66, and she was in a hospital in Boston, and I would be sitting with her, and in those days I was taking a lot of psychedelics, so I'd usually be on something sitting with her. And I'd watch people come into the room, all the relatives and doctors and nurses saying, you're looking better, you're doing well. And then they go out of the room and say, she won't live the week. And I thought, how bizarre that a human being is going through one of the most profound transitions in their life and they're surrounded completely by deception. Can you hear the pain of that? That nobody could be straight with them because everybody was too frightened. Even the rabbi, all of them, everybody, everybody. And she and I talked about it, and she said, what do you think death is? I said, I don't know. I look at you, and you're my friend, and it looks like you're in a building that's burning down, but you're still there. And I figure when the building burns, it'll go, and you'll still be here. And in a way, we just met in that space. So Phyllis, she and I were, I was open, and she could ask whatever she wanted. I didn't say, now let me instruct you about dying, because she would have not accepted that. But then she gave up. And at the moment she surrendered, it was like watching an egg breaking and some being emerge that was so radiantly beautiful and present and light and joyful. It was a being that she, at some deep intuitive level, knew herself to be, but had never been busy being all of her adult life. And she opened to this being, and she and I just basked in its radiance. And she, at that moment, had gone into another plane of consciousness where we were completely together talking, being, but the pain and the dying process was just phenomena that were occurring. At that moment, she was no longer busy dying. She was just being, and dying was happening. And to tell you how extraordinary this, just to complete this story, right at the last moment, she said, Richard, sit me up, because I'm Richard to my family. She said, Richard, sit me up. So I sat her up.
I put her legs over the bed and her body was falling forward, so I put my hand on her chest and her body fell back, so I put my other hand on the back and her head was lolling, so I put my head against her head. We were just sitting there together. And she took three breaths, slow, deep breaths, and she left. Now, if you read in the ancient Tibetan texts the way in which conscious lamas leave their body, they sit up, they take three breaths, and they leave. Who was she? How did she know that? What was that about? I just want to play with you with the mysteries that I play with. Ramana Maharshi, who was a great Indian saint, was dying of cancer, and they said, let's treat it. And he said, no, it's time to drop this body. Because in India, it's called dropping the body. And you hear the implication of it, that there is something that drops the body. The body doesn't drop itself, the body is dropped. And his devotees started to cry, and they said, don't leave us, don't leave us. And he looked at them with confusion. He said, don't be silly, where could I go? I'm just dying. Don't make such a big deal. It's like I'm just selling the Ford, you know. It's not such a big deal. I'm just dying. So the dying center, in my mind, was an institution where people like me who wanted to be around people that were dying as part of their spiritual work on themselves would create the support system, whether they were nurses or doctors or attendants or whatever. And the place would be open to people who wished to use their death as a vehicle for their own awakening. Because as you're going through these processes, for a person that really sees life's journey as a one of spiritual work on oneself, this is an optimum set of experiences to work with, the process of dying. So if you imagine now you have an institution in which everybody in the institution is there in order to spiritually awaken. They're called monasteries or ashrams. And it happens there are dyers and there are helpers of dyers there. But that's ground, not figure. The figure is the spiritual awakening. And everybody's there for the same reason. So you can hear, like, what I experience is that when I am with somebody like somebody, I work a lot with AIDS patients. Now here's a young person who very often is the object of social stigma. They're dealing with family rejection often. They're dealing with an opportunistic illness in which there are symptoms that are occurring in a jumbled mass, and you feel better and then you feel sick and then you hit here and then hit there. They're dealing with economic difficulties. When I come in to be with them, the first thing I have to do when I sit down with them is to open myself to all my reactions to their predicament. The minute I try to deny it, it catches me. So I have to open myself to it. So I have to open myself to my empathic reactions. That is, to me as a separate entity, feeling what it would feel like if I were being socially ostracized, had an opportunistic illness, was young, didn't have a chance to live out my dreams, all of it, all of the pain of it. It's only when Zalman gave me a beautiful line. I was interviewing him for a television show, and I said, Zalman, if you were an Israeli, what would you say to a Palestinian? And Zalman said, oi. Oi, such a problem. He said, you know, he said, before we can be with one another, we have to learn to grieve with one another. We have to open ourselves to grieve for the other person's loss and pain.
And when they feel heard in the grief, then we can start to meet behind the grief. And what I've learned is, in whether I'm dealing in this, because I do a lot of work with political activists, and when I'm dealing with people of different ethnic origins and minority groups and all kinds of diversity, that I can always be my spiritual cuteness and up-level and say, we're all one. What are you so busy being black or, you know, Latino, Chicano, or whatever? They say, oh, that's not going to work. We don't hear. You're not hearing us. You are not hearing us. But if we sit with each other and grieve together, then we rise into the place of unity behind it. So when I sit with somebody, the first thing I have to do is open my heart as a separate entity to this other separate entity and go through the process of empathy. That's not compassion yet, that's empathy. Of as a separate entity feeling what they're feeling. And to be able to do that is interesting. To be able to keep your heart open in hell, really. To keep your heart open when it's breaking in a situation. To do that requires that you have cultivated the spiritual perspective behind it that allows for the wisdom of the universe, that allows for I mean, this is a little much to say, but it's true. It allows for the perfection that exists even within the imperfection. And once you are rooted in that understanding, if you have stood back, if you've been able to stand back enough to see the beauties of the laws of the universe, to see the exquisite intricacy of the unfolding of the spark of God manifesting into form, the Shekhinah, if you see that, just the brilliance of it, you are in awe. And at that point, the little mind that you have, which is just part of the manifestation, suddenly gets humble before that. And instead of saying, this is terrible, this suffering is awful, if I were doing it, I'd do it differently, you say, I really don't understand. But there's a place in me that has faith in the unfolding. And what has happened to me as a result of inner work, which I am talking about and commending to you, is that that two planes of consciousness, living both with the perfection and with the pain of the suffering, allows you to stay with the pain without pushing it away, because you have the balance within yourself. It's as if you're part of the unity and you're also separate. You're part of the unfolding of all that includes suffering. Like with Phyllis, how am I to say now that the pain she went through that forced her to give up, that led to the spiritual awakening for her the few days before she died, I wouldn't have personally given her that pain? Because I couldn't have done that. But am I to judge that as somehow wrong? And I'm faced with the paradox that I, as a human with a human emotional heart, want to take away your suffering. And at the same moment, there's another part of me that understands that suffering is grace. That suffering is the sandpaper from the spiritual point of view that is awakening people. And once you've started to spiritually awaken, you re-perceive your own suffering and start to work with it as a vehicle for awakening. Now, the interesting part of that paradox is you don't say to another person that says, oh, I'm suffering, you don't say, hey, it's grace. See? Because you have to give people space to do what they need to do. And if they're at the stage of their evolution where they see their suffering as this horrible thing that's being done to them, you can do the best you can to remove their suffering, the way they're experiencing their suffering. As my guru says, God comes to the hungry in the form of food. And you get what you need. So when I come in with somebody, let me give you an example. Woman, 42 years old, very wealthy, very beautiful, very talented, very creative, is dying of AIDS. And she comes to me several months before she's dying, and she said, Ram Dass, I wonder if you would help me die. I said, well, great, we'll do it together. So we started to meditate together, we started to talk, we started to read things and discuss them. And she said, I'd like to stay as conscious as I can through this process. The more you are aware of the spiritual nature of life, the more you see the moment of death as a moment for release, for taking off the tight shoe. And the art form in dying is that at the moment of death, you are neither grabbing at life nor pushing it away. You're neither pushing nor pulling. It's the attraction and aversion that keeps you holding to form. So to prepare for the moment of death, when the processes that go on in consciousness are a dissolving of boundaries, a speeding up of awareness, a kind of an opening and expanding. To be in that process where you don't go, oh, no, and grab hold, one prepares. One prepares for the moment of death. And it's interesting that in almost all the Eastern traditions, people see one of the works of life is the preparation for the moment of death. Now, each person does what they can do. We don't make believe we're more ready than we are. So that I'm very pleased that we're getting to the point now where people can decide how much pain medication they need in collaboration with their doctor, rather than the nurse saying, you had it 4 hours ago, you can't have any more. Each person knows, and when they know they have control over their pain medication, they need a lot less, it turns out, because a lot of it is their fear of pain that they're dealing with. So with Mary, as I started to get to know her, she was an absolutely beautiful human being. Her family had ostracized her, and she had wonderful, many, many wonderful friends. And we started to be together in the hospital when she was finally in the hospital. We just sit and hold hands and look in one another's eyes. And what I then was able to do, see, after the first stage, when you empathize with the pain of another person, then comes the next stage where you start to meet the person behind it all. It's like, are you in there? I'm in here. Far out. What are you doing in there? I mean, if I can just run you through this kind of oversimplified model, if you had a little television receiver channel right here next to your eyes, what you're finding, what we're talking about, is planes of consciousness or channels on a television set. And most of us, most of the time in this culture, act as if we have a one or two channel set. We don't have cable. And today we're talking about cable. We're talking about acknowledging all these other channels that are floating around in the room, but we're not picking them up because we don't know how to tune our receiver. That's basically what this is about. So on the first channel, when you look at another human being, you see old, young, dark, light, fat, thin, etc. You see physical body. And if you're obsessed with your physical body, that's what you see when you look in the world, other people's physical bodies. That's the channel you're on. If you flip one channel, then you're in the psychosocial realm. You see power and you see happiness and sadness and neurosis, and it's the therapy channel. It's the social role channel. It's where there are mothers and truck drivers and all lawyers and all the different roles and identities, all the social stuff. And that's all a channel. And that's as the world turns. And it's a never-ending source of fascination. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. Most people are happy with channel two. That's right. In channel one and two, about 98% of the people you've ever known are busy with those two channels all the time. But now we're talking about something else. We're talking about shifting. Now you shift one more channel, and there's a little in-between one, which is called, it's like the astral plane. It's where you're dealing with archetypes, the Jungian archetypes. You're dealing with what's called astral or mythic roles and mythic identities. It's that sort of place where you see people in their mythos rather than in their personality structures. And that's where you see... And then you look at me and you say, he's an Aries, I just knew it. You know, it's a Sagittarius and Leos, and you see there's 12 of us in various permutations. If you flip to the next channel, you go behind all those individual differences and you just see another soul just like you that has all that packaging that's different than you but is just another being just like you. That's when you say, are you in there? I'm in here. How'd you get in that one? And you see all of the stuff of the personality and the astral and the mythic and the body and all of it as like packaging. And you see the spiritual individual entity. And just for fun, if you turn the channel once more, what it is you're looking, it's looking at itself, looking at itself. There's only one of it. It's awareness, aware of itself. And just to keep the Buddhists happy, you turn it once more and it all disappears, which is basically the one in itself. It's basically the one in itself rather than looking at itself. Now, our predicament is that as long as you're on channel one and two, you are afraid of death. Until you are rooted in these other levels of reality, that gives you a perspective about death that allows you to see death as a transformation of things which change. You can intellectually know from channel one and two that after all, it's all nature and we are going to die, but that doesn't dissipate the fear. The fear comes from a gut intuitive knowing that comes from acknowledging these other parts of your being. And I say acknowledging. It's not learning them as if you're getting them from outside. It's acknowledging them from within yourself. And almost everybody has information about these all the time, but everybody's busy not having it. When you're too busy in channel one and two, you treat information from these other channels as if it's error in the system. It's static. I can't bring in the channel clearly, you know. Somehow, I mean, it was interesting. When I was a psychologist, which I guess I still am, when I was a research psychologist, the best we could do in predicting human behavior, psychological behavior, were correlations around 50 or 55, 60 when we were lucky. That's accounting for about 30% of the variability. That means 70% of the differences, the variability, we couldn't account for. And we said, well, that's just the fact that our tools aren't good enough yet. Or we called it error variance. Error variance includes karma. It includes all of the other planes of reality that explain who we are at this moment. And I just like to keep the door open for some of these things. Now, with Mary, when I opened to her, what happened was I've learned something about love, which is nice to learn about. And it's important to understand that in this dealing. First of all, most of our images of love in our society have to do with romantic love. They are poetic love. They are interpersonal love. I love you, you love me, we love each other. We all give lip service to, but hardly ever really acknowledge that there is another kind of love that is not interpersonal. We call it conscious love, or Christ's love, or God's love. And the image I have is that when you grow up in a society of conditional love, which most of us have grown up in because of the way in which we are socialized, we end up very needful for love. And that's why a lot of the literature is about love and affection. It's as if there's something in us that's very hungry. We're on a deprivation diet. And so when we meet somebody who has the key to unlock something in us, we experience that we are in love, and we say, I am in love with you. What we're really saying, another way of saying it in a kind of an instinct literature, is you are the key stimulus that is releasing the mechanism in me that allows me to be in love. You're my connection. And as my connection, I want to possess you, because I'm hungry to be in this state in my being. I have come into the place of love in my being. And everything is beautiful suddenly. But it only happens when you're around. So where will you be Thursday? And where will you be Friday? And where will you be for the rest of my life? See? And the tendency is to want to possess the beloved, which, as you and I both know, is one of the quickest ways to destroy the experience. And that love has in it fear, because somebody's going to die or go away or find another lover or something. Now, that's interpersonal romantic love. And that's why there's so much poetry about it, because it has the fear and the joy and all of the stuff in it. But now, take that image that the key stimulus is something that opens you to the place in yourself where you are love. And through the spiritual practices, and through understanding the metaphysics, and through opening yourself, you find yourself starting, whether you call it awareness, where you draw your awareness back from thought, or however you get in there, through meditation, through devotion, through study, whatever your practices are, you find yourself starting to rest in the place of presence in your being, which has the quality of that openness, that boundarylessness, that heart, intuitive heart space, where you experience that you are in love. But now you are no longer dependent on an external thing to awaken you to it. You're beginning to rest in it. So you are beginning to be love. Now, the social problems that raises are very interesting, because what happens is now everyone you look at, you are in love with. And you don't quite know what to do, because if you've been working on an old deprivation model, you want to collect them all. So you get one and you say, let's nest. And you go back and you get twigs and drapes and, you know, make a nest. And then after some time you say, I'm going to the supermarket to get some tofu and beer. And at the checkout counter, you look at the person at the checkout counter and it happens again. I mean, because now when the eyes, you see, are the windows to the soul, and the soul rests in love. The soul is a being within the place of love. So you look and there's your beloved. Now what are you going to do? You got one at home. So you say, have you considered a ménage à trois? But what are you going to do then? Are you going to not walk down the street and look at anybody? Because it's going to keep happening. And you realize that you're going to have to give up your deprivation model, because there's an abundance of love. You're going to have to stop collecting it. And you're just going to start to go so that you pass your beloved on the street and you don't even wink. So you go through stages of, at first you can't believe it, see. So you go down the street and you meet one and you say, let's have coffee together, or give me your telephone number, you know, in case I run out of the others later. I want to know that this one is, because it's so beautiful. And then after a while, you just keep letting go and letting go and letting go until you realize that isn't the way. You're just living in this presence of love, in which you, because the thing that has closed you down is the fear of the other person's pain and suffering. And once you have that spiritual perspective that allows you to keep your heart open in the hell and the pain and the grief and the stuff, then you can start to be in love with another human being without feeling the possessive quality about it. And so with Mary, I'm sitting with Mary and I am falling into love with her. And that is both levels. The personal level, I'm attached to her, I don't want her to die. I've gotten to love her so much, I don't want her to die. And the other part, she and I are just floating in the ocean of love. And I realize, and what she is experiencing is such an intimate human contact as I am. We are both dying together. And we go right up to the moment of death. And at that point, what happened to me in that case was I then found myself separating myself from her because I wasn't yet capable of staying in love through death. And that's my work on myself. I could stay in love through dying, but not through death yet. And yet, love transcends death. But to be that wisdom is different than knowing that wisdom. And I am dying into that wisdom. Is this too weird for you, or are you still here with me? And because I work a lot with people that are grieving for the loss of a loved one. And my way of in supporting grieving is to say, grieve. My God, grieve. Don't try to stop grieving. Don't be strong. Grieve some more. Go grieve some more. Just allow the human pain. Don't hide it. Just let it keep going through it. And then at some point, you will quiet down naturally. It might take a couple of years, who knows. At some point you will quiet down and you will be quiet enough to realize that the love, when you and another person enter into the space of love together for even a moment, that relationship has transcended relationship. You have entered into a unitive moment together, and that transcends death. And at that moment, when you quiet down enough and you're sitting with your beloved, you suddenly realize that where did they go? As Ramana Maharshi said, where could I go? I'm still here. It's just the form that left. You were busy missing the form. You weren't missing the essence, because the essence is here. And when you recognize that, you feel as a human being enriched by everybody you have loved, instead of deprived by the loss of their form. You realize that they're living through you, and that everybody you've ever loved is part of the fabric of your being now in the way in which you go forward. And that's where grief gets transformed into a living love space, of a spiritual transcendence of the pain. There was a nurse in a seminar that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and I were doing together. And the nurse said, she was about in her, I think, late 20s, and she had three children, and she had advanced cancer. And she had been through many, many operations. And it was a very poignant story with three young children. And she said to the audience, what would you feel if you came to visit me in the hospital? And different people raised their hands, and Elizabeth wrote on the board, and some of them said anger, and some of them said anger at God, some of them said pain, some of them said sadness at your plight, some of them said confusion, a whole list of things.
And she then said, you see the predicament? She said, all of you were so busy being with 28-year-old nurse with 3 children with cancer. Nobody was with me. You see the issue, I mean, when working with an AIDS patient or cancer patient, or anything, the symbolic power of dying is so powerful that it's extremely hard to get through it to be with the person behind it. Like, I have a friend, Kelly, who was a quadriplegic. Kelly was a quadriplegic. He was hit on the side of the head when he was about 9 years old, and it was misdiagnosed, and he ended up... So you can hold his hand over an alphabet board, and he can spell out words, and that's the way he communicates. And he's like this, and he's fully awake and fully brilliant, and he's 33 years old. Kelly is a delight, absolutely a delight. I had Kelly introduce me once when I was speaking before a group of doctors and holistic health healers and about 500 people in the audience, and Kelly was wheeled onto the stage, and of course they were all aghast, you know, like Kelly's like, you know, this. And Kelly spells out RD, Ram Dass, RD says, we are not our bodies. Amen. But when I met Kelly, the immensity of his predicament so caught my consciousness that it took me almost 6 months of visiting with him before I could get behind the symbolic power of his identity, his social identity, and his physical identity, to meet him, to say, are you in there? And now Kelly and I have been together for 8 years, and, you know, I mean, he's just another being, just like me. He's just got his karmic trip, and I got mine. I've just been through a very profound experience with Kelly. About 2 months ago, Kelly said to me, I've decided I've had enough, and I'd like to commit suicide. I said, well, you have every right to do that. He said, what do you think about it? I said, well, a human birth is an opportunity to do incredible spiritual work. And you've been doing incredible work, and there's a lot more you could do because you're still a hung-up, greedy little bastard. But you could do some great work. Kelly and I have a good relationship, as you can see. I said, but you know, I don't know how much... The game is you take what you can take, and when you have had enough taking, you stop. There's no blame, you know. Nobody's going to come and say, you committed suicide, your turn. Not from where I'm sitting. I said, and I'll miss you terribly. I wish you wouldn't, because I really love having you around. But you have a right to do it. The problem is, how are you going to do it? Because he can't take anything. He can't move his hand. He can't take pills. He can't cut his throat. What's he going to do? So we talked about it, and I said, well, I think the only way you can do it is not eat. So, because he can just, most of the stuff goes in, he chokes as he's being fed, but he can swallow. So that day he decided to stop eating. And he called his mother and his father and his step-parents and all gathered, and the doctor and everybody. And I had gone and left for somewhere else. And he kept saying, Ram Dass has given me the courage. I thought, oh, God. And I've decided to stop living. And so he fasted for 49 days. And I spoke to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, now this young man could do a great deal with his life. And, you know, he was being doctory because he had to protect his insurance. And I said, well, doctor, tell me, if you were in Kelly's predicament for 20 years, 25 years, what would you do? He said, I don't know. I said, well, that's the predicament. I don't either. And when we don't know, we've got to give Kelly the support to do what he wants to do, because how are we to tell him what to do? So then, around the 48th day, I came to see Kelly. And he had lost maybe 30 pounds. He was too weak almost to push the button. I mean, it took a long time to get the thing out. And he said, what do you think happens at the moment of death? So I told him what I thought would happen. And he said, it's still all right with you if I die? I said, it's up to you. I'll miss you, and I think you can do more work, but it's okay with me. And that evening he ate. But in those 48 days, he took me through so much. He took his parents through so much. He took everybody. Now, most of the people around him are really pissed off at him. They're really angry at him. How could you do this to us? All I could say, and he said to me, are you angry with me? I said, angry? What a gift you gave me. You took me so close to the issue. You kept me awake with it all the way through. When you get to the place where your awareness is really clear, let me just tell you a story. In an olden time, an army is going through villages and it's killing many people, and it's a Buddhist country and it's disemboweling the monks and it's getting rid of Buddhism, which happened a lot in times of Genghis Khan and stuff like that. And there was one particularly harsh captain, and he had a bad reputation of being very cruel. And he came into this town and he said to his adjutant, what's happening in the town? And the adjutant said, all the people are bowing down to you. They're all afraid of you. And in the monastery, all the monks have fled to the mountains except for one monk. And the captain was furious that there was a monk who was still there. And he got up and he walked to the monastery and he pushed open the gates. And there in the middle of the courtyard was the monk just standing there. And the captain walked up to him and he said, don't you know who I am? I could take my sword and run it through your belly without blinking an eye. And don't you know who I am? Said the monk. I could have your sword run through my belly without blinking an eye. Apocryphally, the captain bowed and left. And when you start to get into the spiritual literature, you start to see a lightness about death. A Zen monk is dying, and Zen monk's masters are supposed to leave a verse. And he hadn't written his verse, and his students were very concerned he'd die before he wrote his verse. So they kept saying, what about your verse? What about your verse? So he picked up his brush and he calligraphied, birth is thus, death is thus, verse or no verse, what's the fuss? And he died. I want to read you just two things, and well, I don't know how much more I want to do, but I want to read you this anyway. I went way out on a limb here, and I had to do this, and I'll explain why. This is one of the hardest stories you'll have to hear. And an 11-year-old girl and her girlfriend went to the Jewish Community Center in the Northwest to play tennis. And they were both raped and murdered. And I was called that night by somebody who said, the parents are people who have read your books and listened to your tapes, and perhaps there's something you could say to them at this moment. And I realized I couldn't do it tomorrow. It had to be done right now. And so I sat down, and the enormity of that pain was so great that it catapulted me out of the ego part of me that felt insecure in writing. And so I wrote this letter which I'd like to share with you. And this letter, well, you'll hear it. Dear Steve and Anita, Rachel, the daughter, Rachel finished her work on earth and left the stage in a manner that leaves those of us left behind with a cry of agony in our hearts as the fragile thread of our faith is dealt with so violently. Is anyone strong enough to stay conscious through such teachings as you are receiving? Very few. And even they would have only the briefest whisper of equanimity and peace amidst the screaming trumpets of their rage, grief, horror, and desolation. I can't assuage your pain with any words, nor should I. For your pain is part of Rachel's legacy to you. Not that she or I would inflict such pain by choice, but there it is. And it must burn its purifying way to completion. For something in you dies when you bear the unbearable. And it is only in that dark night of the soul that you are prepared to see as God sees and to love as God loves. Now is the time to let your grief find expression. No false strength. Now is the time to sit quietly and speak to Rachel and thank her for being with you these few years and encourage her to go on with her work, knowing that you will grow in compassion and wisdom from this experience. In my heart, I know that you and she will meet again and again and recognize the many ways in which you have known each other. And when you meet, you will, in a flash, know what now it is not given to you to know, why this had to be the way it was. Our rational minds can never understand what has happened. But our hearts, if we can keep them open to God, will find their own intuitive way. Rachel came through you to do her work on earth, which included her manner of death. Now her soul is free. And the love that you can share with her is invulnerable to the winds of changing time. In love, Ram Dass. Let me just share with you one more story. When I came back from India in 1968, I was living in New Hampshire on my father's farm. And a young fellow came to see me. He was about 18 or 19. He was living in the Lower East Side of New York. He was from Russian parents. And he was from quite wealthy parents, actually. But he was living as a kind of a hippie in New York with his girlfriend. And he came to see me and he said, I'd like to study yoga with you. Hatha yoga and so on. I was teaching all those things at the time. And we sat together, and he was a very unusual fellow. And at one point, we were looking in one another's eyes, sitting together, and this blue light flashed between our third eyes. And it was so powerful, we both fell over backwards at the same moment. And I had no idea what that was. So he began to study yoga, and he would come to see me. His parents had a place nearby in an island, and he would go there, and he came to see me. And he started to improve. He was doing hatha yoga. Pretty soon he was doing it. By the end of the summer, I said, look, you now need a real teacher. I mean, I'm great, but I'm kind of a schlock, you know, teacher, and you need a real one. And so I'd suggest you see so-and-so or so-and-so. He said, well, I think I have enough of the basics. I'm going to go into a cave on my parents' place down in Arizona, and I'm just going to do yoga all winter. If I can just fly to wherever you are once a month and see you, fine. So every month he would fly to see me, and he was starting to look like a yogi. He was fasting, and he was getting that kind of look about him, and then he didn't come in February, and he didn't come in March, and in April, and I didn't think much about it, in April I got a letter from his mother saying, my son has entered Mahasamadhi, which in India means it's when you die and you enter the enlightened state. Now, that's very strange for a Russian woman to say to me, and I realized she was saying her son had died. She said, I'm coming to see you because I have to show you his diary. So she came to see me, and she was somewhat of a hysterical woman, and he showed me this diary, and it said, scribbled in big scrawl on the pages, was, Mother, I have finished my work. I am with Christ, and I am with Maharaji, which is my guru, who he met through me. Tell Ram Dass it's all right. I will be watching over you. You need have no fear. Vaya con Dios. Go with God. Love. Signed it. She says, see, he finished his work. Now, to be honest with you, what happened to me when I looked at that book was I saw this big scrawling writing. And I thought, where have I seen that before? And then I remembered that in all the times I've taken LSD, there are moments when you are way, way, way out there, and you suddenly see the grand design of the entire universe, and you want to remember it. So I would stagger across the room to get a pen and something to write on. And I'd write this laboriously, this wise thing, which for the next day would turn out to be like the word is. Which undoubtedly was the secret of the universe, except I no longer understood it. So it looked to me like it was acid writing. And I thought, uh-oh, he took acid, and he probably, because they found him in his cave with blood on the walls from his nose, he probably took acid and did pranayama or something and burst his heart and died. So she said, he did finish his work and he's enlightened, isn't he? I said, well, I don't know. But I said, I know somebody who would know, my guru in India, because he knows everything. I'll ask him. I'm going in the fall. I'll ask him. Send me a picture of your son. So she sent me his high school graduation picture, which I put in my valise for going to India. 2 weeks after the mother came, his friend came, his brother actually came, and he said, I've got to tell you this. He said, I went to visit with a friend of mine. I went to visit my brother out in the cave. And I brought some acid, and we all took acid together, and we went swimming. And while we were swimming, he came over to hug me, and I went into a homophobic reaction, and I pushed him away. And he got upset, and he told us to leave, and that was the last time I saw him alive. So now you see what I had in my mind. He took acid, paranoid, went back, tried to do yoga, killed himself. That's not enlightenment. 6 months later, I'm in India. I've forgotten about the picture. It's in my stuff. One day, we're sitting with my guru, my spiritual teacher, and he's looking through everybody's bags and taking out their pictures and looking at them and kidding about them. And I remember this picture. So I go back to my room and I get the picture and I bring it out. I don't say a word about it. I haven't talked to anybody about it. And I place it on his the thing he's sitting on in front of him. And he's talking, and finally he looks down. He looks at this high school graduation picture, and he says to me, "He's dead." I said, "Yep." He said, "He died from your medicine," meaning the LSD. "He died from your medicine." I said, "See, I knew it." And Maharaj looked at me and said, "Nay." He heard the tone of my voice. And then Maharaji said, "He is one with Christ and with me. He finished his work. He is watching over his mother. She need not fear." And he quoted word from this boy's diary. Right? Exactly, word for word. And he said he told her to go with God. He said he finished his work. And when he said that to me, all of my models about how you're supposed to die were completely undercut. And I realized that when somebody was ready, the hook came out from the side of the stage and they left. And our models of you're supposed to go out dancing were just our models. That it was a much deeper story than that. And my guru said, "Nobody dies a moment before their time, and nobody remains a moment after it." And in Tibet, where they have cultivated so much awareness free of identity with that which changes, there are lamas who are so conscious that they will, there was one that sent out cards to everybody saying, "I will be dying next Thursday at 2. Won't you come by for tea?" People came, they had tea. He turned around 3 times, sat down, went into samadhi, and left his body. Now, I just want to play with the edge of the mystery with you. The mystery of Anita's death, the mystery of Mary's death, the mystery of the mystery, the mystery, the mystery. In Tibet, when they're giving you the instructions, they say, at the end, they say, as the earth element leaves, your body will feel heavy. As the water element leaves, you will feel dryness. As the fire element leaves, you may feel cold. As the air element leaves, your out-breath will be longer than your in-breath. The signs are now here. Don't get lost in the detail. Let your awareness go free. Imagine, "Oh, I'm thirsty." She's thirsty. Give her water. "I'm cold." Instead of, "Ah, the earth element. Ah, the water element." Just recognize what an adventure this transformation is. The appreciation of death and the spiritual journey after death is the prerequisite for living life joyfully now. Death does not have to be treated as an enemy for you to delight in life. Keeping death present in your consciousness as one of the greatest mysteries and as the moment of incredible transformation. Imbues this moment with added richness and energy that otherwise is used up in denial. I encourage you to make peace with death, to see it as the culminating adventure of this adventure called life. It is not an error, it is not a failure. It is taking off a tight shoe, which you have worn well, but those that find the way in the morning can gladly die in the evening, it is said in the mystical literature. So I encourage you to explore and find in your being that part of you that is on those other channels, so that when on channels 1 and 2 the World Turn series comes to its final chapters, you won't be caught in feeling loss, but rather the adventure. Because from where I'm sitting, life on this plane of reality, because I live in the world of reincarnation, of karma, of life on this plane is like being in the fourth grade. You took birth here because you had certain work to do that involves the suffering you do, the kinds of situations you found yourself in. This is your curriculum. It's not an error. Where you are now with all your neuroses and your problem, you're sitting in just the right place. Imagine that. Imagine that. Nobody made an error. And all that stuff in you of saying, if only I could be. No, this is it, including the if only. It's perfect. And then at the time you graduate and somebody says, oh, but he died so young. So if you graduate from fourth grade early, big deal, wonderful. Don't get so caught in worshiping life that you lose the balance, that realizing that the spirit it says, live life fully and richly as a partner with God, and at the same moment, don't be afraid of the next thing. Go towards it with openness and with love, and not with forbidding. The way that is understood in the morning, one can gladly die in the evening. Just for a moment, sit quietly now. Say, sit quietly, and everybody rustles. Isn't that far out? Everybody thinks, now I'll meditate. Sit quietly for a moment. And just be with what is. If you're hot, be hot. If your behind hurts, let it hurt. If you're emotionally open, let yourself be emotionally open. If you're closed, be closed. If you're bored, be bored. If you're stimulated, be stimulated. If you're hungry, be hungry. Just let it all be. Bring your awareness to your breath. just resting in the breath, and let all the thoughts and plans and memories and sensations, let them come and go as they will, and keep coming back to just noticing the breath. Now focus on the breath in the chest. Just let yourself reflect now about a vast sky before you. And crossing it are clouds coming from out of your vision, going out of your vision. The sky is vast and present. The clouds coming and going. Imagine now that that sky is mirrored within you, so inside of you is a vast sky, right in the middle of your chest. It's a vast sky of presence. And every thought you have, and every sensation you have, every model you have of who you are or what it's all about, see all of those now as clouds coming and going, rising in your mind, disappearing, rising in your body, disappearing. And keep focusing on the sky, on the vast sky that is not changed in any way by the clouds. Just one more image. Imagine a vast ocean. Rising up out of the ocean are waves. The waves rise and then they dissolve back into the ocean. Be the vast ocean of awareness, letting thoughts, sensations, plans, memories, hopes, fears, life, death, all be waves which rise up out of your awareness and sink back into your awareness. Cultivate resting in awareness. No coming, no going, no birth, no death, just vast ocean. When you have learned to rest in that part of your being, pure awareness, pure isness, pure consciousness, pure love, pure beyond form, no form, just vast presence. Ah, life, ah, death, ah, coming, ah, going, ah, joy, ah, sadness, all of it, waves that come back into the vast ocean. When you know that quality of your being, the ocean, the sky, the awareness, then you are free. And being free, you can dance the dance of life and the dance of death. May all beings in this very life be free.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.